He said he had jokes. Here's one now. Good evening, everyone. My name's Mike, and I am an alcoholic. In fact, since I moved down here from the People's Democratic Republic of New Jersey, Stan, in 2010, it was inevitable that I got Jersey Mike. And now, thanks to my sponsor's sponsor, who's still in New Jersey and will celebrate 50 years this August, when I go to a meeting in New Jersey, they call me Jersey Mike. Anyway, I am an alcoholic. And I like to tell people that as far as I'm concerned, I'm probably the luckiest bozo you're liable to run into today. And that luck really started before I was born. AA saved my life twice. My father was a lieutenant in the Army in the Pacific. He was in charge of a group that maintained 150 landing craft and operated them at garden spots like New Guinea, Eniwetok, the Philippines. They would load up troops, take them in through Japanese fire to the beach, load up wounded, bring them back, lather, rinse, repeat all day long. And then after that, he was Army of Occupation in Japan. He was in Hiroshima before the end of August 1945 and stayed till sometime in 1946 when he came home to what was then home, Allentown, Pennsylvania, to two surprises. One was his 2.5-year-old son, my older brother, who'd been born while he was overseas. And the other was that kid was being raised by his wife's sister and his wife's parents because his wife was a roaring drunk. And if my mother had not found AA on March 31st of 1947 on her third shot, I wouldn't exist because my father would have picked my older brother up and hauled freight. It was that bad. So that was one. The other one's on me. Now, we did not have a bad family life at all. I mean, we were reasonably well off. When I was about seven, my father lost his job in Allentown and moved to outside of Philadelphia, the northern suburbs. And he apparently got a pretty good bump in pay for that because they also bought a fishing boat at that point. I'd gone to the Jersey Shore when I was 5 months old. I grew up on the beach in the Jersey Shore. And now we moved from Seagirt to Manasquan, New Jersey, so we could operate the boat and go fishing. And they enrolled me in, well, my brother and me, in a boys' private school, K through 12, in Chestnut Hill, PA. And this is where my difficulties with life kind of came to a head. This was a school which was all jocks. Sports were everything. If it was football, basketball or baseball, and some hockey and soccer, but mostly football, basketball, baseball. Okay, at my height in high school, I was 5'7", 119 pounds. Not football material. Okay, and I had glasses, heavy glasses at that point, and I was a little bit smart, so I kept screwing up test curves for the jocks. I was not a popular fellow, and I kind of developed, I suppose with a little help from my parents, this feeling inside, A, that I really didn't belong here, but B, that was probably because I was more intelligent than all these big, dumb bozos, and that's why I didn't fit in. Well, that only goes so far, and my brother was 6.5 years older. He got into Princeton University, and I don't know if anybody here is familiar with Princeton, but they don't have fraternities and things like that at Princeton. They have clubs, which you pledge in your sophomore year. And he got into Elm Club, and there were all sorts of football game weekends at Princeton. My uncle, my mother's sister's husband, was a Princeton graduate. Two of his kids went to Princeton. It's all in the family. So we would go there for these game weekends. And on one of these, when I was 13, my brother had his girlfriend with him. And the parents went out to dinner with the uncle and aunt and left me with my brother and the girlfriend. Now, this is the ultimate third wheel, okay? My brother and his girlfriend at Elm Club, the band going, rooms upstairs, and a 13-year-old hanging around. Not good. Told the bartender, take care of him, okay? Just, you know, keep him entertained. Disappear. Well, the bartender misread that. What he thought was, feed him Tom Collins's. So I got a Tom Collins and took a few sips. A marriage made in heaven. I had the answer. Now I knew. Now I knew. I could dance. I could talk to people. I could talk to girls. I could be funny. I could be entertaining. I could enjoy myself. This was the answer. It was love at first sight. Now, people talk about, you know, blackouts being one of the big signs that you're getting bad. I had blackout the second time I drank. I was trained by experts. As soon as I knew that fact, I wanted to have more of that as soon as I could. And every chance I could, I did. Started with beer, graduated up over the years. I ran into friends. I had a habit of finding friends that were two things. Number one, larger and older and could get away with a fake license if they weren't old enough to buy. And two, very large. So if I was a wise ass, they would keep somebody from kicking my, you know. But they also trained me to drink professionally, to oblivion. That's how I learned to drink. If somebody didn't have to tell you what you did the next day, if you had any memory of it, you didn't enjoy yourself, you didn't do it right. Hangovers, given. Blackouts, given. All part of the problem, all part of the fun, you know. And at that point in time, and for some time thereafter, it was not a problem. Well, there was one problem. My mother became an alcoholic during Prohibition and was sober quite a while at that point when I was running around. I could not get away with anything. I got caught almost every time. Not good. But she knew enough not to, you know, say too much. She knew I had to make my own path. And that must have killed her. But more on that later. Anyway, there were also other problems, one of them being a particular young girl. And those problems got to be more of a difficulty than the alcohol by far. And I was sent to another school in Princeton, interestingly, for my junior year. And then that wasn't far enough. So for senior year of high school, I ended up at a prep school in the middle of the Los Padres National Forest in California. 3,200 miles ought to about do it. And I didn't have anything there. I mean, they had horses you could ride. There was hiking trails everywhere. There was wildlife. There was all kinds of stuff you could do. But I didn't see any drugs or alcohol when I was there. So an interesting thing happened. The grade point average that had gone down came back up. And I found out that things like the SAT and the achievement tests, those were all the rage then for college admissions. I could knock those into a hat. A multiple choice test, get out of my way. I was good at those. I was good enough that I applied. At that point, I also took French a lot in junior high and high school. I got absolutely fluent in it by the time I was a senior in high school. And I really liked the idea of marine biology. I saw myself with Jacques Cousteau on the Calypso, you know, running around the planet, speaking French and diving with sharks and all this stuff. It sounded great. So I applied to four colleges with good marine biology programs. I applied to Stanford, University of California at San Diego, Miami, and Hawaii. I never even got to look at Hawaii. That was so expensive, we couldn't even look at it. I did not get into Stanford. I got into Hawaii, I got into UCSD, and I got into Miami. And I chose UCSD University of California at San Diego. Now, that was a fatal decision. So I arrived in California, San Diego area, La Jolla, actually. I was also a surfer when I was, you know, growing up at the Jersey Shore. And now I'm in the heaven of surfing. Black's Beach was right down the hill from campus at one of the best breaks in Southern California. But my priorities were otherwhere. Within a week of getting to college, I had found who the bowlers were. You see, bowling was the only sport I ever found in high school where I could kick these guys' butts. Because size didn't matter. And I got good at that. So I found the bowlers, the guys that got together and had a few beers at 11 o'clock at night and then drove down to Frontier Lanes in northern San Diego where they had five games for a buck after midnight to practice. Those were my kind of people. And they also happened to be, most of them, in a particular service fraternity, which I also pledged, and from which 2 years later I was blackballed for drinking, believe it or not. The drinking fraternity, I got blackballed for drinking. Anyway, freshman year was parties, keg parties and all that sort of thing, and bowling and having a good time, and somehow I survived academically. Didn't do great, but I survived. So sophomore year, things had to be juiced up a little bit. So let's see. If you can go down to Mexico and buy cheap booze, maybe things come up from Mexico. How about that? So that year, I introduced drama into the picture. I ended up minoring in drama and theater. That plugged a hole in the social life a little bit. And I discovered a group of people who were pot smokers. I know a lot of people don't like to hear about drugs and pot and stuff like that, but it is an integral part of my story. And in my book, it saved my life later on. Anyway, now I have just about the whole picture. I've got surfing, I've got drama, doing plays and stuff like that, great social life. I can tutor French. I can work for one of the guys in the fraternity as an AV projectionist to get beer money. I got it made. I'm set. I am ready for a higher education. I'm ready. Long story short, gets to be 3 years later, and I'm ready to graduate from college. How? Beyond me. I must have soaked it in by osmosis or something. But I was graduating college with a degree in biology pre-med from a tough school, minor in drama and theater. Now, fact is I don't remember graduating college. I do not remember 9 days between the end of my last exam and 2 days after I got back to New Jersey. Just little bits here and there, little bits. No solid memory of graduation at all. I've seen pictures, and I see why I didn't remember it. I was scrooched, no question. But now I'm back on the East Coast with a degree in biology, bachelor's degree in biology. Now, at that time, that and $5 would get you a cup of coffee at Starbucks. If you didn't have an advanced degree, nothing. You needed something else. So I'm looking at least another year of grad school somehow, maybe med tech, something like that. And I have no money because it's all been spent on pot and booze. I have no savings. I have no job. I have no prospects for a job. So what am I going to do? Well, I'll get married. Perfect sense. And here's the first higher power interest here. I married a girl who had a lot of drug problems in her family. So I had to give up all of that stuff. No more magic mushrooms, no more peyote buttons, no more pot. But I was fine. That's the point I want to make. I had to give all that stuff up. And I was very fond of those things. But it didn't matter because I could drink. I was fine. I was perfectly okay. And that's legal. And we all know alcohol isn't a drug. You can buy it anywhere. So I'm set. So I go another year, I get a medical technology certification. Thank God I passed that exam on the first shot, because nobody could have talked me into taking that thing again. That was a beast. But I'm married, and I now have a job. I'm over in Raritan, New Jersey, working for a J&J company in the lab and really enjoying it. And now I'm on my own. I'm out in the real world. I'm married. I have a job. Everything's set up right. Now we get to fill in. We party on Friday and Saturday night. Great. Well, that's good. Let's try Friday night, Saturday, Saturday night, Sunday. And then Sunday night, a little bit. Now let's do the whole weekend. What the heck? Now the whole week's just sitting there. Oh, company bowling league on Wednesday night. I take care of one right there. And then maybe a beer after work be good. And if one's good, two's better. And three's even better than that. It took me less than a year and a half to become a daily drunk. And that's quick work, folks. That's quick work. That's just hard work, effort, you know, diligence, conscientiousness. I did it. I got there. And that's how the next year or so went. And everything was going great. I mean, I was averaging, at this point, I was averaging about 175 in a league and bad temper, very erratic game. But I still believed that if you didn't have a few brews, you couldn't have that nice, smooth arm swing that you really needed. You know, I was not a power bowler. I wanted the nice, easy, gentle stroking game. And I had a pretty good game, but I didn't have the mind to go with it. So comes the time then I get called on the carpet at work. And they have noticed that there are days when I am not quite at peak performance. Notably Mondays and Thursdays. Remember the company league on Wednesday night? I'm not quite right. You know, like I walk into the lab and I walk past somebody and they go, Jack Daniels, Black Label, oozing out of my pores. I got to go see a counselor at Somerset Council on Alcoholism. Now, this is going to be great. So I walk in, and there's this guy. The guy's name was Jack Strickland. I owe that guy my life. I talked to him, and basically we had a couple of sessions. We just swapped stories for an hour. It was really pretty good. The end of that time, he says, you know, I'm not going to call you an alcoholic. And I'm like, whew, thank God. I said, but I think it's got you a little bit, because every time I suggest cutting back or knocking it off for a while, you don't like that idea. I think you better try and control it, because I think it's got you a little. You better control it, because you might have 20 years of good drinking if you can keep it under control, but you might have 20 minutes. I don't know. You got to control it. Okay, you've been drinking to oblivion for 10 years. You're going to control it. Right. How are you going to do that? Okay. So, party the weekend away because that's the last hurrah, you know. Go Monday and Tuesday, white knuckles, holding on, vibrating like a tuning fork. Come to Wednesday, there's no way I can bowl without it. So I got to have just a couple of beers to keep the game going. It didn't work, by the way. White knuckles on Thursday, white knuckles on Friday. Gets to Friday night, I got a whole week. I proved it. I'm not addicted to anything. So I'll have a beer. 7 or 8 weeks, I'm right back up to daily drunk. Everybody's looking at me funny. Everybody's, you know, my wife's looking at me. We have a kid by that time. He's looking at me funny. Cut it back out, back down to nothing. 6 weeks, right back up. Yep, better cut it out, time again. 5 weeks, right back up. And this was really hell. I mean, it was just the beginning of hell, but it was hell. Because I was supposed to be controlling it, and my great capacity, I mean, I could drink those big jocks under the table in high school and college. I really could hold a lot of liquor, but now it starts tapering off. And the things I'm doing in blackout start to be a lot stupider and a lot more embarrassing and in many cases dangerous, and not to mention illegal. How I did not get a DUI during this period and later, scandalous incompetence on the part of law enforcement in New Jersey. Absolutely worthless law enforcement. They should have had my tail a lot of times. Anyway, things are getting real out of control here. I'm starting to think, and I also work for J&J, so I have access to one of the best medical libraries in the state. Maybe UMDNJ might have a better one, but I don't think so. So I'm looking up everything I can find on alcoholism, all the Betty Ford stuff, you know, all the stuff from, you know, all these places that have done work with alcoholism. I'm trying to find a loophole is what it is. I know everything there is to know about alcoholism, except one thing. So I'm still working on this, and I go back to the counselor on my own once. I said, you know, something's not working here. The guy says, why don't you try going to an AA meeting? I don't know about that, but, well, there's one right near my house, open discussion meeting. So I go into this open discussion AA meeting. They took one look and said, we got one here. One guy goes, takes me aside and says, try to identify with what you hear tonight. Don't compare. Try to identify. Okay. I identify with everybody in that room. It scared the hell out of me. It scared me so bad that I went to that meeting every week and drank the other 6 days. It did not work. Did not work. So now, not only am I trying to control drinking, which is becoming more and more impossible because I'm blacking out on one beer and doing stupider and stupider stuff. And there's also all the matter of empties and stuff to get rid of and all that. But now I'm trying to do something about my drinking. And there's no way I can hide what's happening to me when I drink. You know, I'm really having a problem with this. But I keep this up. And finally, I'm to a point where I would get up. I've spent probably over 2 years waking up every single morning with a screaming hangover and raunching gut. Just, oh, crap, not again. And going and checking the toothbrush. Was it damp? Did I remember to at least brush my teeth? Is the car still in the garage and in one piece? What happened? Is anything broken? And then I choke down a cup of coffee and get myself to work and somehow gut it out through the morning, get a little food in at lunch, start to feel a little bit better, and I'm going straight home. I'm not going anywhere near a liquor store. And I go straight to a liquor store, buy a couple of sixes, go home. Repeat, 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 repeat. And the hangovers, by the way, are getting worse and worse and worse. The stuff I'm doing in blackouts is worse and worse and worse. Everything in my life is starting to come down around me, and I can't stop. I had no choice about going to that store and buying that. My car was programmed. I couldn't stop it. I could not drink. And that went on and on and on. And one morning, exactly like 700 or so other mornings, I woke up, and instead of, oh, crap, not again, the word was enough. Enough. And that, to date, has been enough. And that was August 29th of 1978. I'm still here. Now, I would love to tell you that my family and I walked off into the sunset with rainbows and unicorns, and everything was great. Bull. I had quite a bit of a problem that not every alcoholic, I suppose, has, but mine was extremely, extremely difficult. Me. See, I knew I had the first step at this point. I was powerless over alcohol. Absolutely. My life was definitely unmanageable. I knew I was an alcoholic, but there wasn't a power on earth that was going to make me like that. As far as I'm concerned, It's not like I felt that life and God had backstabbed me. I mean, this is like I'm tying my shoe and they came up behind me with a dried corn cob. This is real bad stuff. I did not like this. I did not want to be an alcoholic. No way. This was absolute crap. And as a result, I was a serious pain in the ass to these poor people in AA that were trying to help me. And the other thing is, of course, my mother, by the way, has not said a word to me all this time. Bless her heart. She had plenty to say on every topic. She never confronted me. How much that must have cost her. She knew I wouldn't listen to her. She knew she could only hurt. So she stayed out of it. So here I am. There's no one around me in AA that's lower than about 70 years old. They're all crotchety old men and women. They smoke a lot of cigarettes. They drink a lot of coffee. They swear like pirates. But they're enjoying their lives. They're happy. They're comfortable in their own skin. This is something I don't know anything about even before I drank. I don't like any of these people or any of what they say, but I want what they have. So what do? Well, you try and fight it like I did and make it very difficult for everybody and make it take a long time and be real painful. I mean, I was doing what they suggested just to shut them up and get them off my case. I didn't want to hear about it. Well, as far as I have looked back very hard and talked to people that were there, as far as I can tell, every single time, without exception, that I did what these people told me to do, it worked, and it worked well. That pissed me off even worse. Not only are they all these other things, they're right. Ugh. So these guys kept at me, and I was in a group that was old, hard-line, serious alcoholics. Thank God. They put these people where I needed them. I mean, God put them there. And I had a real problem with that part of it, too, the whole spiritual side of it and all that. A real problem with that. That started back when I got married, because I was an Episcopalian by birth and raising, marrying into a Catholic family. So get to the wedding, it's like everybody does this except you. And we all do this, but you can't. And, you know, I'm like, okay, when do I get to paint myself blue and sacrifice a goat, you know? So I had a real problem with churches in general and God in particular. So every time they do something like that or talk about the spiritual, I'm looking at the ceiling tiles, counting stuff, waiting for it to be over. And there was one time, my sponsor, the one guy under 70, is a guy about my age, every bit as Irish as I am. He's a couple of years older. And he's walking, courtesy of the state of New Jersey, for a DUI. Why I'm not, I don't know. But I start having to pick him up and take him to meetings and take him home. So I'm getting three meetings for one. Did I need it? Absolutely. So one night, we're driving home, and it's dark, and we're on the back roads in New Jersey, and I'm in one of my rants talking about stuff, and I notice it's dark, but I can see he's kind of shaken. He can't be laughing. And it's just like in the book, you know. At this point, the sponsor usually laughs. Finally, he just cracks up. You know, he's just laughing like crazy, tears coming down his face. Just, when the hell are you going to give yourself a break? You've told me 400 things you did that you should have died, or you should have killed somebody else, or you should have been arrested or jailed or institutionalized. You're here and you're sober a couple of months. When are you going to give yourself a break? Who do you think's doing that? You think this is all coincidence? That made me think a little bit, you know? And they didn't pull any punches with the meetings either. I mean, first meeting, can you help pick up the ashtrays? You know, oh, sure, but why? Well, you're filling them for one thing. Another thing, it's got to be done. And besides, it's a position of responsibility, because if you don't put them out and everything, we burn down the meeting hall and everybody beats you up. Okay. Get to be a couple of weeks or months. Okay, lead the meeting. What? Nope, just follow the script. Just do it. Just do it. That was something I heard a lot. All the sayings they kept hitting me with, you know, tough S, don't drink. You know, keep coming. Meeting makers make it. Well, I kept meetings, but the other thing is that I got involved in things with the group where they do service stuff, where they book commitments. You know, we went every 3 months, we'd go into Newark. Everybody in northern New Jersey, all the groups would book commitments in going and outgoing. That had to be done, okay? I was booking chairman for a while. I got 90 days. They did not suggest that I should go speak. They said, get in the goddamn car. I had to speak, you know? Okay, well, now you're going to be chairman of this group for the next 3 months. You're going to make sure all the commitments are covered. You're going to make sure the incoming is coming and know how to get here. You're going to make sure that the outgoings are manned, and if they're not, you're going to go. Okay. Well, after about a year, they say, okay, now you're going to be treasurer. You know, it kept going like that. And I needed every bit of it. I needed every bit of it. Now, my wife and I at that point, actually we had 3 kids, and I jokingly used to say we had 3 kids, one of each. We had a son, we had a daughter, and then we had another son who really marched to a different drummer. I mean, this kid, fundamentally the problem with this kid was he was me. He was me. He had a lot of problems in school and out. And that caused a lot of friction in the family. And the marriage, we stayed together 17 years after I got sober. But it finally blew apart. And we separated, and I moved into a place in Manville. And I met, after about a year and a half, I met a nurse who also had a bad childhood, really bad childhood, but she was funny and she was smart and she was very cute and we got along great. And we ended up buying a house together. And then the romance part of it just crashed and burned, but we were still really good friends. So we were able to live together and be good friends and get along, and that was fine. Thank you again. And this, we're getting up to about 2008 or so at this point. Now, at this point, there's been really no romance in my life for about 7 years. Well, I'm still bowling. Oh, I forgot about that part. I said I was 175 or so and erratic when I was drinking. I got my PBA card in 2002 as a senior, professional bowler. I was bought into a pro shop, and I was doing a lot of that on the side, drilling and fitting bowling balls and giving lessons and stuff like that. I got pretty good. So we got this idea one time, why don't we get some autographed pictures of pros to put up in the shop? Now, I always had a few pros that I had miles of VHS tape on. You know, miles. Remember VHS tape, anybody? Okay, I got racks of those things. I had footage of Dave Davis, Dick Weber, Brian Voss, Norm Duke, Lisa Wagner, the really classic games. And when I taught people, including my own kid, you want to know how to throw a bowling ball right? Look at that. Look at those people. And that's what I tried to emulate. So we got this idea, what about autographed pictures? We got the local guys, you know, that was easy. Parker Bone, Johnny Petraglia, Roger Gardner, Pat Brennan. And I remembered that my partner had introduced me to Len Nicholson, who used to do the lanes for the PBA Tour for about 20 years. So I gave him a call and said, how about asking some of your friends to send us, you know, just a good luck with the pro shop signed photo we can put up. A couple of days later, I got an email from one of those super female bowlers that was a goddess to me, said, hey, I hear you want a picture. And we started emailing back and forth, you know, and we got to be pretty good electronic friends. I mean, this was a real good thing for me. And it got good enough that I started thinking, I really love the way this lady thinks. And I mentioned it once, and it turned out she'd been thinking the same way. So we arranged to meet in the middle. Now, she lived down here north of Atlanta in Gwinnett County, worked as a vet tech. Another thing, animal lover, big animal lover, all my family, all her family. So we met, and that was that. We got married in 2013, and we're still together. And talk about the higher power looking out for you. This lady's amazing, and she's absolutely amazing. She's also the best cook I've ever met. And she can do just about anything she puts her mind to. She worked as a vet tech. I got a job down here when I needed one badly. I'm getting ahead of myself a little, but during about 2009, I had kind of fallen off on meetings a bit. I was very busy working, and then in the end of 2009, I got downsized out of a company that was on its way out the bottom of the scale, and that was about the worst time. We'd also lost the pro shop at that point, and I didn't know quite what was going to happen with that. And I got strong messages from HP that I should get back into meetings real quick. Like, I kept hearing from people I used to know in the program, or I'd run into a couple of people I used to see at meetings, and the message was very clear. I'd learned to listen to those. So I got back into meetings. And it turns out that that was not just you need to get back to meetings, but you better be ready. You're going to need them. June 2nd, 2010, right before I moved down here, I got a call from my ex-wife. Our youngest kid, who was then 30, had killed himself. He had had a problem. And he got into a situation where everything crashed at once, and he didn't see any alternatives or ways out. He was down in Houston, and that hit pretty hard. And interestingly, the first call I had to make about that was to his godfather, my original sponsor, who was lived up in Maine at this point. He was there the next morning at my front door. That's how AA works. He was there. He drove all night. That's how AA works if you get involved in it and know people. And I got through that. And I got down here to a new job and a new marriage and a new life. And at that point is when I started thinking about above the group level service, because I'd done all the stuff in the group level, the treasurer, the secretary, the chairman, booking chairman. I'd done all that stuff. I'd never really gotten into the higher levels of service. So when I got down here, I started looking at doing that. Better late than never. So I did get into it down here. And it's been a blessing. It's been a real blessing. When the hell am I going on time? Okay. It's been a real blessing. I've gotten to meet even more really outrageous folks, especially when you consider that they're really nothing but a bunch of drunks. I mean, they're really great people. I mean, I've met a lot of great people. And as far as I'm concerned, if there's another unpleasantness like in 1861, I'm going to wear gray this time. New Jersey can hang. I'm a Southerner now. Jersey Mike or not, I'm a Southerner. I like it here. I like it here in Georgia. AA is very solid. Around Noonan, you can't throw a brick without beaning somebody in an AA meeting. It's great. They're everywhere. Good ones, too. Got a lot of old line AA. And I still run into people that do things the way those old crotchety people did back in my home group. It's still there. It still works. And people still need to hear it that way. I didn't want anything to do with that stuff, but it worked anyway. And through AA, I found that higher power who had been studiously protecting my butt for I don't know how many decades without my even acknowledging it. Now I know that higher power. And by the way, that higher power has a real sense of humor. And when it comes to instruction, he does not believe in subtlety. This is a higher power who has a Louisville slugger. If he wants me to get a message, he gets the message across. And I respect that. And all of that, all of that, and my health, which I should have lost, all of that I owe 100% to AA. I wouldn't have any of that. I wouldn't have had any of that if I hadn't gotten sober in AA, in addition to the fact that I wouldn't be alive if not for AA. So thank you for listening. I'll just close with one beautiful remark, which is so true. I heard it from another guy in New Jersey who said it at the end of every talk he ever gave. When I got here, they said, "Bring the body and the mind will follow." And I keep coming, and every so often I look over my shoulder. Thank you.